My name is John Allen. I'd like to welcome you all to one of the last workshops of this convention. We're going to talk about concert halls and their acoustics. And when I always say when we're going to talk about acoustics, let the arguments begin. Because there's an awful lot of talk about acoustics and what it should be, what are the best halls, what aren't the best halls. And when you look at the history of concert hall acoustics, you do see that, particularly with Leo Baranek's research, that there does seem to be a consensus as to what the best halls really are, and that consensus doesn't seem to change over time. What I'd like to do is just quickly run down and tell you who's on the panel, and then as each one speaks, I'll give a more formal introduction because people do come in and out. But on my left, we have Dr. Barry Blesser. My immediate left is Jonathan McPhee, conductor of the Boston Ballet and several other orchestras. To my right is Dr. Leo Baranek. To his right is Larry Kierkegaard, acoustical consultant. And we have Chris Blair, an acoustical consultant and the designer of the new and spectacular hall, I have to tell you, down in Nashville, Tennessee. And also a special guest at the very end, Alan Valentine, who is the president and chief executive officer of the Nashville Symphony. And wait till you hear what they have to say. Start with Dr. Barry Blesser. He's considered one of the grandfathers of digital audio, the digital audio revolution. He invented and developed the first commercial digital reverberation system, helped start Lexicon in 1971, and published a landmark paper, Digital Processing of Audio Signals, in 1978, co-chaired the first international conference on digital audio in 1980, and was advisor to the U.S. Justice Department on the Watergate tapes in 1974. Dr. Blesser was president of this society in 1980. AES awarded him the Silver, Bronze, and Governor's Medal, both publication awards, and made him an AES Fellow. He most recently has written a book, Spaces Speak, Are You Listening? Experiencing Oral Architecture. And that is why I've asked him to come here. I'd like to talk, before we talk about music, I'd like to talk about why we respond to music, why we respond to the acoustics of the space that we're in, and why it seems to matter to us. And he's always a provocative guy, controversial guy. He always messes my mind up whenever I talk with him, and I thought I'd like to mess up yours a little bit. So,
thank you, John.
Barry, go right ahead.
Can we have my computer up there? There we go. I was privileged to be among all these luminaries up here, and I'm not sure really why they invited me, because they know far more about concert hall acoustics than I do. However, I ended up in this book trying to put my career and everybody else's career into the larger picture, and since they only gave me 15 minutes as opposed to 15 hours, this is abbreviated. So let's address the question, what makes a concert hall great? This is the topic. And the simplest answer is the answer. If people like it, it's great. And really, that is the answer. If people don't like it, it's not great, because subjective preferences are personal. And now you get into the question of subjective evaluations, and there's a vast body of literature having to do with food and wines and all kinds of other things. Concert hall acoustics belongs in the same category. Whose opinion is relevant? Does science actually predict taste? The marketeers will tell you, no, science doesn't predict taste. It can measure what taste is out there. So to add a little humble pie to this collection, in my view, to provoke everybody on this panel, science is a post facto explanation. It tells you how people have behaved and why the patterns are what they are, but it doesn't predict what they're going to like. And one of the things I discovered in the book is preferences change with culture. Preferences are not a biological imperative. We were not born to like a certain concert hall. We may like it. I like it. I agree with the panel. What they like, I like. So let's look at subjective preferences. And I just put down a list of things where people have preferences. Wine, food, automobiles, poetry, sculpture, clothing, cookies, cakes. There isn't one cookie out there. And there isn't one type of spouse, and there isn't one type of wine. Why should concert halls be different? Why should there be only one kind of best concert hall? Is there a one kind of best wine? And if I had more time, I'd tell you some funny stories about wine. So I'm taking the position, unlike everybody else in the panel and perhaps in the room, there can't be an absolute. there may be a consensus among a certain group of people listening to a certain kind of music for reasons, and science may do an exquisite job explaining what the consistency is, and using the science of that consistency, they may be able to build a hall which is even better based on the preferences of that group. But it can't be an absolute. Now, what's the problem with oral experiences? There are several problems. I just threw down a few. You can't compare two different concert halls because you can't jump from one space to another. And while you can simulate different concert halls, so the only people who can compare concert halls are people who have a well-developed oral memory. You have to remember what this concert hall sounded like 2 weeks earlier when you were there. Oral memory and oral appreciation are not the same thing. You can't talk about your preferences without a language, and the language of sound in general is unbelievably weak. Most of our vocabulary is borrowed from other senses. Two very expert people know what they're talking about, and I once overheard a conversation between Leo and Dave Griesing, and they could talk in a shorthand. They could say, you could use two words to describe an oral experience. Why? Because the words they were using were referencing a shared experience. The words were not describing the experience, they were merely keying it. Okay, now, this panel's going to talk about great concert halls, and I'm going to ask the question, who are the opinions that count? Well, the musicians on stage, but they're already a different group than the audience because they got special needs, special requirements, and their criterion for greatness may not necessarily be the same criterion as the audience. Acoustic architects who like earning a living building concert halls, conductors when they're really active on as opposed to just figureheads, are very important in determining what's good. And in general, you develop a pattern. Those people whose opinions should count, they have a passion for music, often a particular genre. They have extensive experience, maybe hundreds if not thousands of hours listening. They've invested a lot of time. And they're unlike my 19-year-old son who loves music but has never been inside a concert hall. His opinion probably wouldn't be solicited. But maybe from a marketing sense, it's equally important. And let's see how I'm doing. I got to check my time because I tend to go on for hours, and that nobody would like that. Okay. I'm just going to do a quick summary. What is musical spatiality? Now, I'm not looking at acoustics, physics, measurement. I'm asking the question, what is the experiential aspects of a concert hall? What is the experiential attributes of a space? And in music, there's only really two issues. The space reverberation spreads the sound in time. You get the decay process, which essentially elongates the note and becomes an extension of the musical instruments. You get spatial spreading, which says the music is not coming through a tiny little opening. It's all around you. You're embedded in the music. Now, these two experiences are completely different. They have different functions, different meaning, and different people may evaluate them differently. There's no guarantee that they're the same, even though they came from the same physical process. And when you go to a concert hall, the origin of the concert hall was to keep the rain off your head. Everything else was social artifact as you follow these traditions. If you're willing to accept electroacoustic music, they've got their own musical rules of space. If you listen to a recording, the space was created in the recording studio with equipment that people like myself and Dave invented, but it's tuned and adjusted in ways that suit the art. There is no space. There's lots of spatiality. So spatiality trumps space, and this group is looking at a historic tradition of spatiality implemented only with a physical concert hall where people go to that space to keep out of the rain, to be isolated from the environmental noise, to have a social community that they're part of. So concert halls are a subset now. They weren't a subset when Beethoven was writing his music. That was the only venue. So we have the concepts of spatiality, which is not the same language as acoustics and interaural cross-correlations and, you know, all the different measures you'll hear about. These are different ways of looking at it. It's a different language. Now, just to argue that there is no one truth. Here's a concert hall-like environment that happens to be natural. Stockhausen did this performance in the caves of Lebanon. There's lots of literature on how unique it sounds. It has nothing to do with concert halls. It is an experience where you're essentially 100% in the reverberant field. There is no direct sound. Nobody is closer than a couple hundred feet from the performers. This is a musical experience which many people who were there found overwhelming high impact and loved it. Now, had you been able to build this space here, had these caves existed in New York City, we might very well have come up with a different musical tradition where those people who really liked being entirely enveloped without direct sound would have chosen this as their preference. The 1930s had an attitude where acoustics was poison, noise, and should be avoided at all cost. And if you look at this stage, that arch there is not just an arch. It's solid acoustic absorbing material. This is probably one of the deadest spaces in the world. You hear by electroacoustics, and they thought this was the best space in the world. This is another form of space. In England, they create the space entirely electroacoustically, where you can create spatiality as you see fit. These are different spaces, and of course, we have the Boston Symphony Hall. Each one of these spaces has its passionate advocates, different periods, different times, different musical genres. So, and the last one here is the Greek Amphitheater, which was also a very critically important space for its purpose and its time, and it served a very important function. Now we come to, how am I doing, John? Okay, we got it. What is quality? There's a book, which I can't remember the title, but it looked at all the artistic innovations in music and looked at the social reaction at the time of innovation. And universally, the new unfamiliar art forms, whether it was composition, whether it was a space, were detested. Now, after the fact, people rationalize as to why. Boston Symphony was detested and criticized, and people will now explain, well, they didn't have enough performers up there. They had
the hall was
disliked. So, I don't know anything about the orchestra at the time. Okay, people say, well, they didn't understand it. It was new. It had to get seasoned. They had to add more instruments, different selection, different kinds of composition. All that's true. But in fact, the bigger pattern is when a new art form is disliked, an old art form that you're familiar with is loved. Not universally, but one of the constituents is familiarity. So scientific explanations, which you'll hear about extensively, make a bunch of assumptions. If a group of stakeholders has a consistent opinion, and we know now after Leo's work and other people that there is a consistent opinion among those people who go to concert halls, who spend a lot of time listening, who have trained their ears to be good listeners, who have an oral memory, who have an investment in some aspect of the experience, there is a consistency. Science can measure the properties of that consensus. No question about it, and they can get better and better building halls for that constituency, for that class of music. But the consensus changes with time and cultural shifts. In other words, this is not science except post facto explaining the purpose, what the properties of these halls have. So basically, I'm not disagreeing with anything you're going to hear, but I'm adding a caveat as saying, how should you understand what you're going to hear? And that's the trouble I'm trying to cause.
Well, thank you. When we talked the other day, I was the question that came into my mind was, do we learn what we like, or do we like to learn it?
Do we have experiences, and then whatever we are familiar with becomes what we like? Don't reject the possibility.
Well, I've not, but I just, there are certain kinds of music that seem to be popular all over the world, and they're
in different periods.
Yeah.
Different periods. There's no consistency. In other words, what's popular today would not necessarily be popular in 50 years from now.